Back in March, presidential hopeful Barack Obama spoke about race and revealed some uncomfortable truths within his own family.
My white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe.
Obama's speech was heralded as an historic moment in America, opening the door for honest national conversation about America's racial realities. But talking openly about race in this country isn't easy. Now a new psychology study says it's especially difficult for white Americans when they're in a racially mixed group to speak openly about anything race-related for fear of being labeled racist.
The study measured biases that 30 white subjects had against black images. The biases, even subtle ones, were enough to make those white subjects so afraid of being thought racist that they'd rather avoid all contact with black people.
To find out more, we spoke with Jennifer Richeson. She's an associate professor of social psychology at Northwestern University, and she co-authored of that study, The Threat of Appearing Prejudiced and Race-Based Attentional Biases. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, Jennifer, your thesis, as I understand it, was people are self-editing to such a degree that they end up avoiding subjects that are going to make them uncomfortable altogether, and more often than not, these have to do with race, and that inherently is bad. Why?
Yes. I mean, the real argument is that we have almost been focused so much on how racial bias affects interracial interactions or what people say and do, and not that we should not focus on racial bias, you know, or should stop focusing on that, because there clearly are bigots still out there. But there's also these other concerns that have come to the fore in part because of the racial progress that we've made, where people are concerned about appearing prejudiced, and some people respond with a lot of anxiety. And what we're arguing is that this anxiety then precludes the very diverse encounters that would lead people to actually become less biased.
You point out that a lot of this is because, for the most part, Americans work in a much more diverse racial landscape than ever before. And so you're coming into contact with people who don't share your skin color. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Yeah, it is. And it's a good thing for us to be concerned about what is said. I mean, it was certainly, you know, you got to kind of think back to what it might have been like before. I mean, certainly in corporations, I mean, you can see this with sexism all the time, when there were very few women or only women were in sort of support roles, you know, as secretaries, the men who worked there could say whatever they wanted, and there was absolutely no sanction for doing so. And in order to bring more people in, more women in, people who were, you know, different in, the organizations had to mandate some new norms, some new standards, and that was very good and really important. The only thing that happened is that some people respond to these new norms with uncertainty about what they can and cannot do, and we know that there are very strong social sanctions for getting it wrong around issues of race and certainly issues of gender. I mean, people get, you know, they lose their jobs, right? I mean, we have this sort of the whole Don mm-hmm. Imus thing, and we repeatedly see, you know, these events that become, you know, held up for public scrutiny, where people are almost, you know, kind of, I almost often say to my students, you might get kicked off of the morality island, you know, for saying the wrong thing. And it's that kind of anxiety around the possibility of messing up to that degree. And that's what we're saying is holding people back from even engaging in interracial anything, in diverse anything.
Were you able to extract any kind of anecdotes, Jennifer, with the people that you talked to about some specific examples of when a white person was in a situation where they had a thought that ordinarily they would have said it had it been an all-white group, but because there was a black person in the room, they didn't say it?
Oh, I mean, it happens all the time. Not, we don't have this from the study, but I teach a class on the psychology of stereotyping and prejudice, and we have these conversations all the time where students say that, you know, they sometimes don't even want to watch certain television shows if it's a mixed audience, because you don't know whether or not people will respond to the humor in the same way. You know, you almost have to wait until, you know, the people who are, maybe if they're black people watching, do they laugh? Okay, then maybe I can laugh. You know, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety around, you know, doing the wrong thing.
The other effect of turning race into the third rail of American conversation, which is basically what you're talking about, mm-hmm. is that if all overt racism goes underground, there's the possibility that even a slight misstep or bubbling up of some sort of word that, you know, someone could take the wrong way is interpreted as real racism.
Absolutely.
So perhaps it's not only a problem among the white community. Perhaps the black community is convinced that there's a lot more racism than there is. Just because they don't hear it overtly, they figure, well, it all must have gone underground, as opposed to thinking much of it must have dissipated.
Right. I mean, it becomes an entire problem, right? Because if you don't know what it's going to look like, or you only have kind of the very few sort of real bigots and then everybody else, well, what do we call everybody else? You know, and I think we need to get out of the business of sort of, you know, giving the scarlet letter brand of bigot on people until we, except for the people who really are, right? I mean, for most part, we're not. I mean, none of my participants are sort of Klan robe wearing, you know, bigots in the way that we used to think about them. And so that type of branding is really not useful, and certainly not useful to forward a conversation. What we're really dealing with are people who often have very little experience with interracial interaction, first of all, but also are just forming their attitudes, you know, or even those who aren't, you know, are just kind of seeing, well, you know, what do I think? They might be challenging their attitudes, and having this conversation might be what gets them there. And I think in general, we probably need to be a little bit more generous.
So, Jennifer, if you were to advise a local chapter of the NAACP or Al Sharpton's National Action Network, there, which is going to happen, I'm sure,
they'll have
you on retainer. There are two schools of thought, right? One is that you have to be vigilant and you have to call it out whenever you see something that is institutional racism, or, you know, a powerful person in the media maybe doing something that's racist. The other side is if you call it out and you're very vocal about every single situation, you get what you're describing, which is so many people just shut themselves down. How would you advise someone who wants to both be vigilant but on the other hand not quash the conversation?
Well, I mean, I think that there's nothing wrong with the vigilance, actually, and I think that if anything, we need to be more vigilant about our own behavior and our own thoughts and hold ourselves accountable. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with accountability. What I do think has become the problem is that we just get stopped at, oh, you said that or you did that, you're a racist. Right, and that, I mean, where do you go from there? You know, mm-hmm. and there's no place to go from there. So
I think you have to go on. You have to go on Al Sharpton's radio show.
You have to go and
apologize.
Exactly.
And maybe the BET
network.
No, I really have
some black friends, or really, my heart is not biased. You know, so I think that the problem is that our model of bigotry is wrong. Our model is you're either a good person or a bad person, and if you're a good person, you can't possibly be biased. You know, and maybe if you're a bad person, you kind of are, or maybe bias shows that you're a bad person, and that's just a wrong model. It turns out that you can actually be biased in the ways that we're talking about, these sort of these subtle, you know, biases that people have, the stereotypes that we all have in our heads, that, you know, you can be that and be a really good person.
Well, because those words are inherently different. I mean, a bigot is very different from the word prejudice. Those are completely different words.
Right. Right. I mean, and we've made them to mean even more than they probably needed to mean to begin with, right? We have this set image of what that means. And I think we need to let that go because, for the most part, that's not what we're dealing with. And so the only alternative we have is to keep proving ourselves to be good people, right? And if we're good people, that means we're certainly not biased. And that does nothing to actually make us less biased. It just makes us feel better about the biases that we deny that we have.
You know, a version of what you're saying is playing out on the presidential campaign, where Hillary Clinton's backers are saying, you know, if these sort of attacks were aimed at a black woman or a black man, no one would stand for it because race is the third rail of politics. So it's almost as if every aggrieved party says, well, why can't we, you know, be like the African American community where you can't say anything bad about them? They almost want to have their special status, whatever it is, become the third rail.
Yeah, I mean, and I hear that argument. I think that there is some truth to that, but I don't think that that's necessarily where we want to adjudicate these questions of how to sort of rid our politics and just our society from the vestiges of sexism or racism.
Yeah, there's something really distasteful about trying to measure which is less offensive.
Yeah, the victim Olympics or something like that.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah. It just doesn't work. I mean, I think and that's been part of the problem with the analysis, I think, of the presidential race is that, you know, there's an assumption is that we can, you know, reduce these candidates to either their race or their gender, you know, whatever they happen to be the minority on. But the truth is that they have different challenges because of the ways that sexism works and the ways that racism works. And so they're not even battling in the same lanes, right, on the same track. It's not that they're, you know, kind of on a parallel track, and whoever gets there first, then that's how we know which one is worse or which one is better. Mm-hmm. They're not even on the same track. I mean, they have very different issues to contend with as a function of racism, right? I mean, racism doesn't really say that someone can't be commander-in-chief the way the sexism does, but sexism doesn't make the argument that, can you be the face of America? Are you American enough? Do you represent us in the way that racism does, right? So they're not even battling the same hurdles, right, is I guess, to keep my track metaphor going.
Right. I'm thinking one's trying to tread through shark-infested waters, and the other's trying to tread through, like, lions in the jungle or something.
Maybe,
just,
yeah, I don't know.
Topography.
Although I'm sure there's some, like, you know, racial metaphor that can be used for that, too.
So.
Right. Oh, Lord. Oh, no, wait a minute. And I'm a white guy, and you're a black woman, and I said that. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it.
You must avoid me for the rest of the day.
In that context of this study, as you look at this election, is this allowing us as Americans to have frank conversations about race? As you look at what's unfolded, the dialogue in the wake of this Democratic primary, is it giving us that chance? Are we talking more honestly, or are we avoiding more than ever?
I think we're avoiding more than ever, but we can't, right? Or at least we're motivated to avoid more than ever, but it's impossible. So I think, you know, that's the great irony, is that, you know, we do have this forced opportunity to think about, you know, both racism and sexism and how they affect electoral politics in this really important way. But there's just so much at stake that it's so hard to, you know, to really have the conversation that we had the opportunity to have. Does that make sense? There's just so much at stake, and people have such strong feelings about it that I think it's almost impossible to have the conversation now.
Jennifer Richardson is an associate professor of social psychology at Northwestern University. She co-authored the study we've been talking about, The Threat of Appearing Prejudice and Race-Based Attentional Biases. Jennifer, thanks so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
You. That was a good one.
Yeah, I like that conversation.
Semi-obscure studies that we raised to prominence. What I was born to do. Like I said to you before we did that interview, the second hardest sentence in American culture is the one that comes right after, you know, we really need to have an honest conversation about race.
Yeah,
we do. Crickets.
Now what do we say?
Crickets.
Well, hopefully we added a little value to that conversation with that interview.
Not really. I mean,
come on. Yes, we did.
Ah, come on. Us? What can we say? We're white.
You're right.
Well, what do we bring to the table? Come
hopefully
on.
Something. Come on. Stay with us. Next on the show, an in-studio performance with the Mates of State. You don't want to miss
they're live. Well, not literally live, but
they
live
came into the studio.
Tape.
They played.
Well, not literally taped. It's like this digital thing we have.
Can we go to commercial break now? This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.